So there's three yogis. And they go up to the mountain on this lake, three little cabins. And so they go up there for a retreat. And there's a little lake there, and they decide, you know, the sun's coming up, goes on the other side of the lake. So they all go over there to sit and meditate. So they all begin meditating, and one of them says, "Shoot, I forgot to hang up my shawl. It's wet, you know." So he walks across the water and puts up the shawl and comes back again. And then the second one says, "Oh, I forgot my underwear is still wet. I got to go back." So he walks across the water also and then walks back, you know. And the third one is, by this time, he says, "You know, well, if you guys can do this, I can do this. You know, I know this is a test." And he gets all huffy and puffy. And so he stands up and steps out. And down he goes, you know. And at this, he's really frustrated and kind of, he's going to do it again. So he does it three times. He does it. And each time he steps out and he goes under, you know. And so the first monk kind of looks at the second monk and says, "Do you think we ought to tell him where the stones are?" No. So hopefully there's some stones to cross the headwaters here. It's challenging. This idea, first of all, that there are the three marks of existence, which we've been talking about, is the all compounded phenomena is impermanent and in flux. All tainted and stained states are painful. And then the third. They use the word anatta, not self. And I know for me, this was like, what do you mean, no self? You know, it's in a sense, you know, I thought first, oh, this is just Buddhist concept, right? But I didn't really get it, it's particularly my early years of this practice, you know. But it is one of the really great insights about really the truth of the self and sort of how we can hold it and how it operates. So I'll weave this in towards the end about Sangha, because it actually can do this, you know. Once you break down kind of the self. So this summer, I took a group. I like trekking around the Himalayas. So I took a group of 20 people up in the Upper Mustang. I'm supposed to go to Mount Kailash. I don't know if any of you know, but that's one of my, it's kind of, to me, a hero's journey in Western Tibet. That is the holy of holies, and it's been the pilgrimage spot for what they say 10,000 years, and that particular mountain is a great representation of the pinnacle is supposed to be enlightenment, and underneath are the hell realms or something like that. But it's a fantastic truth that people have gone there for a reason. And it's the middle of nowhere, you know. So this summer, I decide, okay, I'll do one more. The last one I did was in 2008. You know, and we had 3 feet of snow there, so it was a little tough. So this time, I go, and we 20 people, and the Chinese prevent us from going, you know. So first, it's sort of like, you get all these people's anticipation and everything going, and then you say, sorry, you know. So that kind of started out on a interesting note. So I had to come to another plan. So my other plan was to go up in Nepal, also behind, these are all, because it was in June, actually. It was 28 days. And so it was behind the Annapurna Range, so you don't get the weather there. So this is Upper Mustang, and it has a lot of caves that were inhabited at the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago. So it was a fascinating trip, and very hard. I had no idea it was going to be that hard, up and down, and just, you know, getting almost to 70 and going, I can still do this, right? You know? And so finally we survived the trek. No one gets hurt. Everything's cool. A few knees and backs and elbows and stuff, you know, and just the usual, you know. And so we get to the end of this, and we're in the Kalikandaki Valley, and that's the deepest gorge in the world, okay? And it's spectacular. And we were to get a plane, one of these little 16-passenger planes. We had to fly out, and we kind of got set up, and we all walked in there, got really early in the morning, and by 11 o'clock we realized the monsoon had come in, and it had been, you could see where the clouds came and stopped, you know, but the planes couldn't get through, and actually I knew, but I didn't tell them, a year before that one of the planes did get through and crashed. So they're a little more cautious, you know. So we had to go down the road and take this very high off the ground four-wheel drive bus. And, you know, it sounded, well, anyway, you know. And so we take off down this road, and it is really scary. I mean, there's just the drop down. The Kalikandaki is this monsoon time. So it's just, you know, the pounding and the roaring is phenomenal. And so we get down maybe, a third of the way down toward this, going to Pokhara. And we come, and there's this waterfall. And this waterfall is... I mean, it is a waterfall right in the road, you know. And so we come up to it, and I was kind of riding shotgun. And I go, oh, boy, you know. And it's interesting because you either, you know, the youngest member of our crew, she got off the bus and ran. I said, everybody has to stay on the bus. And suddenly there was that, you know, a little bit of fear, and how you suddenly, the self, you know, either is counterphobic, you know, kind of go, which is kind of my style, you know, go against it, just, you know, go on through. I don't know what we would have done, you know, but I was convinced that we could probably make it, you know. And to give you a description of this, there's this waterfall. And the water's probably, maybe 2.5 feet deep, you know, so the bus is right in the water. And so I said, nobody get off the bus, because we need everybody to keep the bus down, you know. And then we, you know, we have to do this one run, and there's one rock. If we don't get on that rock, there's a 35-foot drop. And then it kind of goes down to the river, you know. And it's so interesting that, you know, when you're kind of faced with something like that, and being counterphobic, of course, I go on my guy thing, and we're just going to, you know, jam through it. But I also recognize that some part of me, I was totally constructed in how I was and who I thought I was. And I realized fear, which, you know, sometimes is just titrated in our world, you know. But with it, we create this identity, you know. So I had this identity that I was going to, you know, jam through. And we rode over this one rock. And riding over that one rock, all we had to do was be about 4 inches on the other side of it, and we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here, you know. And after we went over it, then suddenly I felt the you know, I pushed myself and then felt the fear and realized, oh my God, just, you know, this was ridiculous, you know. But it was that construction of myself that was so, you know, I mean, I'm pretty loose. It's not a big deal, you know. But this, you know, when fear's there, and I got it, this is how, you know, you totally construct self, you know, and fear. And it's interesting in our society, you know, I think when we, you know, had horses and ox cart and everything was slow and there was no internet and all that stuff, the kind of fear that was there was somewhat different than today. You know, with the reality of everything moving so fast and job insecurity and changes and all that, there is actually a kind of a built-in cultural, even, you know, in the mall and everything, a cultural tension that is really based on fear, you know? And that fear is that constructs who you think you are, you know? And it's just natural, and it's talked about sometimes as there is two truths. One is the relative truth, you know, that John is a neurotic, you know, and likes to climb mountains and, you know, kind of challenge things in himself. Is one side, and the other one is the absolute, that actually, if I can say this, you know, I have that nature of completely awake, you know, that it is inherent a part of who I am. And that is not the relative self, you know, it's simply also a truth that that exists. But a lot of our practice here is actually our willingness to kind of study that kind of cultural truth that when there's this fear is actually something that is titrated, I believe, in our culture. You know, just I think sometimes even cars and all of it create that. It is kind of a defensiveness that's there. And that defensiveness is all based on a concretized self, you know. And it's not that, you know, it's not that we're trying to get rid of it. You know, what we're trying to do is actually note it and recognize that we do have some awareness of how it works, you know. And I think it's lovely being able to kind of sit and, you know, the concept of no self is a concept, okay? But the recognition that there are times when certain events or activities happen that you enforces and constructs that kind of protectiveness that is a kind of instinctual self, you know? But we come to this practice. And this practice is based on, first of all, just creating our job here really is to create a safe environment that is that where in a sense, creates the constructions is at least minimized. I mean, I know you make up your own stories about everything, okay? You're not going to get away with that one. But as a kind of collective place here, we've hopefully taken as much of that away. So you are actually watching that constructs who you think you are, you know. And it's amazing that your thoughts, you know, we are incredibly self-centered, you know. It is amazing, you know, how we create that, you know? And the ideals here is somehow that you're going to have to look at this with your storytelling, with your past or whatever you want or plans or whatever. And that you're actually watching this truth of the construction over and over again. And hopefully you start to get tired of it. You know, I think sometimes that's all these practices are about. You just, you know, is it the same story? You know, and does the story seem to go on? And it's really not about the story, it's the construction, you know, the identity that happens there. And sometimes I think it's just, you just have to get tired of the stories, and then you start seeing there's a process here of loosening, you know, of actually, in a sense, kind of giving who you think you are space, you know. I'll read to you, one of my teachers I loved, actually, but he was nuts. But he was brilliant, and he was a fabulous teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He begins to realize that the world was never outside himself, that it was his own dualistic attitude, the separation of I and other, that created the problem. He begins to understand that he himself is making the walls solid, that he is imprisoning himself through his own ambition. And so he begins to realize that to be free of his prison, he must give up his ambition to escape and accept the walls as they are. The more we struggle, the more we discover the walls really are solid. Maybe that's kind of the game here, you know, with your stories. The more energy we put into the struggle, by that much we strengthen the walls, because the walls need our attention to solidify them, you know. You got it? You know? So essentially, we actually have to see the construction itself, you know. And I think that the storytelling is actually an important part of it, because not that you keep repeating sometimes the same old stories, but there is the pattern of seeing that somehow, if you look really closely, is it the same one, you know. And it moves at such a speed that we kind of construct it together, and we think that's who I am, you know. But if you go back to that first mark of existence, which simply says that all compounded phenomena, including yourself, is impermanent. It's in flux, you know. And so that construction of a concept of who we think we are is, in a sense, a momentary experience. And that momentary experience is actually not the same thing, you know. I think there's one other piece of Trungpa's that's really kind of helpful, I think. You know, I can find it here. The experience of oneself relating to other things is actually a momentary discrimination, a fleeting thought. If we generate these fleeting thoughts fast enough, we can create the illusion of continuity and solidity. Continuity and solidity. It is like watching a movie. The individual film frames are played so quickly that they generate the illusion of continual movement. So we build up an idea, a preconception, that self and other are solid and continuous. And once we have this idea, we manipulate our thoughts to confirm it and are afraid of any contrary evidence. It is this fear of exposure, this denial of impermanence, that imprisons us. It is only by acknowledging impermanence that there is a chance to die, and the space to be reborn, and the possibility of appreciating life as a creative process. So, from that description, the self is arising and passing away. And in that, we have created a construct. And that construct is, in a sense, a concept that we are something solid. And that the self is not in a relative sense, in an absolute sense, is something, you know. And, of course, this is probably, it's sometimes, I think, the pinnacle of, if you say Buddhism, of the kind of truth of these practices, that you begin to see that who you think you are in that context of I and me and mine is simply a fleeting experience, you know. And this is a great news, you know, because it actually then gives us some space with all of our old garbage that we're all carrying around with us, that we're actually not that. We're not fixed to it. It is just something that, due to the cosmic conditions, arises. And in a sense, we get kind of caught. As we get caught, we just keep on believing it, you know? And we're here, actually, in a sense, to kind of take some of the veil off of the, you know, somewhat the concept. But the fact is, this is about freeing yourself from it, you know? And I do see, you know, how culturally, I think you know, in the cultural of individualism that we have here, and the massive also insecurity that's, in a sense, constructed, you know, and in society it kind of gets, I don't know, I think it gets a little crazier all the time, you know. But with that is the instability. You know, and then we shore ourselves up. And I hope that this whole process here is ultimately, if you feel safe enough, and if you look close enough, you really begin to understand that it's simply a construct, you know, and that you're actually arising and passing away in fractions of a moment, you know, and there's something so liberating. You know, it's not something, I can't give the concept of anatta, no self. What I can say is point to the fact that it is something that is simply true if we begin to change our view from content to process. Okay? That this is simply, it's no longer a thing. It's simply we have, we kind of recognize that we're in process, you know? And it is not not something that we understand that, you know, when we become afraid, we kind of clutch. Well, that is actually constructing a kind of tainted and stained state, which is painful, you know. And practice is actually learning to not believe it so much and to liberate, on some level, liberate. You know, it is just liberating every moment, you know. It's interesting to me that awareness itself, that Gil was talking about this morning, you know, at the beginning of the sitting, it is so paramount that really it's only something can be noticed in the present. And therefore, it's not something about the past or something about the future. It is this marvelous experience of, in a sense, a kind of awareness without a dualism, without a self and other, you know. And that actually becomes the ground of liberation, you know, that we begin to see that the awareness it's never been anyplace else. It's always been right here, you know, and that it is not caught. It doesn't create stories. It doesn't actually even care about a past, nor does it care about a future. It simply recognizes that when you're okay and you begin to notice, that the noticing itself is enough. This is from the Chinese Chuang Tzu. If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again, and yet again, and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not angry. If you can empty your own boat, crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. You know. Lovely, you know. The process of this begins with the fact that we've all come from unconsciousness, you know. And we have been caught in the suffering of unconsciousness. And we come to these practices and we actually enter a world of self-consciousness, you know, but it's a self. But we're using the self to actually point at the consciousness. And so in a lot of these practices, we have to construct that awareness, that mindful, the mindful of the moment that recognizes that, you know. And so self-consciousness is simply the tool here, you know. And you can get very tired with it sometimes. But it is the tool that actually is leading to thinning out the self. And so it simply goes from unconsciousness through the world, which is a somewhat long world of self-consciousness, to simply consciousness. And consciousness itself, which actually we experience a lot. You know, we don't recognize it because we're totally hooked on the charge of pleasantness and unpleasantness. You know, and we're in a sense almost addicted to that pleasantness. And the reactions to unpleasantness, you know? And yet, there is also, which, by the way, there's a lot of construction around that. But there are also these moments that don't have a charge on them. They're not something. And they're happening a lot. But we don't put any credence on them, you know. They're just, oh, that was just nothing, so I, you know, go on. Oh, now I've got a charge, now another thought, you know. Oh, there I am, you know, and I start again, you know. But the idea here is to actually begin to recognize that there is, it's like a space between thoughts, or it's the space between a breath, and that is actually where the freedom lies, you know. and that it's a way to, in a sense, kind of empty ourselves, to be an empty boat. No. And it doesn't happen overnight. But again, the repetition of that self-consciousness, getting it and seeing, oh, there are moments of just consciousness, you know. But we didn't believe it. We didn't believe it, you know, to say emptiness has something is kind of a bit ridiculous, you know. But the truth is that space between things, that, in the sense, that kind of emptiness is a great, great gift that really the Buddha has been passed on to us, that is it. That empty moment is phenomenal, you know, because its nature is simply that when there isn't a charge on experience and there's simply that moment, you start to get what peace is, that peace is something absolutely available. And it's available at any time, you know. But we have to surrender sometimes, you know, discomfort in the body or some one thing that happens. You have to go, oh, we let go of that for a minute and see that there is this possibility, you know. It's not anything. That's why it's so hard. It's why you come here, and sometimes I think the word vipassana, you know, is... You know, sometimes it's translated as special seeing or a clear seeing, but I like the translation of actually to see into the subtle, you know, to see into the subtle, you know. And if we begin to see into the subtle, then that's not noticeable actually becomes a path, some rocks to walk across. So it's really a process of, you know, that on that bus, it was kind of, that was all about contraction and maybe a little bit of foolishness on my part, but, you know, or bravado or something. But it was constructed out of fear, you know, and it constructed me in being somebody, you know. And if I had to be somebody, then I had to prove that I was somebody, you know. I think we do that occasionally. But anyway, that sense of it, you know. There's something, and it happens, you know. And I think in our world, that it's a kind of a natural reaction somewhat. But there are also moments like this, you know. Moments like this are so precious, you know. You know, even if you're caught up in your story, whatever, there's still these moments. And these moments are informing you about this possibility of peace and ease that is not dependent on the self and the storyline and the frames of the movie and all that. It's not dependent on that, you know? And so there's a process here, ultimately, which is wonderful, is thinning the self out. So, you know, I can't tell you what anatta is. I don't know what anatta is, but I know that there's a process that we do here that thins the self out. And when we begin to thin the self out, then suddenly it is not so self-centered. You know, the self-centered is not such, you know, one recognizes and sees how that stained and tainted state causes so much pain and suffering. You know, and then at that point, you know, we begin to recognize, you know, oh, you know, you know, when you kind of get it at that point, you know, you begin to see, oh, what was this thing about separateness? You know, I constructed so much of the separateness which actually, you know, created a feeling called loneliness, you know, somehow, and in my loneliness, I was special, you know. And this is saying, oh, no, it's okay, you know, I thin that out, and that idea of specialness begins to wane on some level. And then that was separate is no longer separate. And we begin to see, and this is where Sangha comes in, that suddenly, we're here together. And that separateness was actually, but a delusion that was built up. Part of it, just survival level stuff. But so much of it was extra, you know? And that we start to break down that separateness. And breaking down that separateness, then suddenly there is awareness of other, you know? And when there's awareness of other, then when we, in essence, kind of go for refuge in this practice of shelter and safety, we see that there is, this awareness, this awakening, kind of Buddha. We see that there is truth. And the truth is something that when we listen deeply, and whether it's just out in nature, watching nature be nature, that we get what Dharma is. And that Dharma also has, as a kind of a Buddha Dharma, a unique characteristic, because it points to the Nibbana, or the emptiness of things. You know, it's not going to construct anything out of anything. It's simply going to leave it alone. I don't have to make up, you know, that somehow this is all controlled by something. It's actually just seeing that it's okay, that there's kind of a place that isn't holding anything, and how freeing that is, you know. And we have Sangha. And Sangha, you know, traditionally there's kind of, it's kind of three levels. And one is the fact that, you know, there are kind of beings who have experienced a certain amount of freedom. And to me, they are due their respect. You know, and I've had the great fortune in my life to meet in this last century some, you know, incredible beings that were really, that I felt were free and inspired me in some way that, I can, as much as I bumble along, they inspire me to keep going. You know, that's their quality of who they are. And then there is this ordained Sangha, you know, that one of the things I love about the ordained Sangha, I mean, I feel so blessed by the gifts that I have experienced. But I think it's wonderful that, you know, except for the rainy season, that as a monk, you have to go out and beg for your food every day, you know, and that one of the 227 rules, whatever, is you can't keep food overnight. So what does that mean? That means you have to go and allow people to touch who you are and what you represent. You know, that is the beauty of the ordained Sangha, is that somehow they become a human kind of vessel for our, you know, our first kind of truth of how this works. And that first truth is that there is a tremendous amount of letting go just in physical things. You know, if it's a little ball of rice, if it's, you know, $1 million, it doesn't matter. The point is that to let go, you have to start somewhere, you know. And in that case, it's actually the physical act of letting go, you know, and that has a identifiable freedom that is inherent in it, you know. And so in that way, we may say, oh, they're, you know, they walk around in orange robes or, you know, or whatever robes. But they're representing kind of, in a sense, some of the highest part of ourselves in the sense of how to let go, you know, and that we can participate with that. in that tradition. There's also us, you know. And I was going to say, I am so happy to be here. You know, to be in a community that, you know, you're all here with, the, first of all, the most fantastic intention. And whatever that intention, it's always about something, you know. And it's always about some piece of freedom. You know, I want to let go of this, or, you know, or... there's a part I want to see into that emptiness, or see into that no self, or see how that, you know, my mind keeps circling me. And, oh, I get to study this whole operating system, you know? And this community comes together to study all of this, you know? And in studying it, there is the possibility, you know, that you begin to see the gaps between it all, you know. And in doing that, then all here are, in a sense, kind of supporting each other. This is in the immediate circle here of, you know, I think sometimes, I used to, in walking, you know, sometimes I would go out and I'd be thinking something, you know, and there would be somebody who was so intent, you know, right near me, and I would wake up, and that was Sangha. They were actually, or, you know, they sat there so still, and I went, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to just see if I can't do a little of that. And so we each kind of are here in some way affecting each other in community to actually do this practice. And then there's the world out there, you know. And, you know, one of the wonders of this for me over all these years has, the truth is that, you know, I was telling somebody, you know, I was in the valley coming to Spirit Rock or whatever, and I stopped in Fairfield or something, and I went into some convenience store. And I live in the country, you know, and I left my iPhone on my dashboard. And so somebody broke my window and took the iPhone with all my material, you know. And it was amazing, my reaction. It was sort of like the same thing that happened coming down the Kalikandaki, you know. You know, but it was interesting because there I could do something. So I started pacing back and forth, and I was going, you know, what started going through my mind was, you know, all this material on earth. Oh my goodness gracious, you know, your whole world is like in this little teeny thing, you know? And I really, my first, probably for, you know, 5 minutes, I was walking back and forth. And then I got it. I started stomping my feet, you know, and realized, oh, I was so out there. I was, you know, out in iPhone land, you know, computer land, you know, and suddenly it was like, no, I'm here, you know, and it's one of the great gifts of this practice is to bring yourself back to your body, you know. It's really true, and that when the mind kind of lines up with the body, you know, everything, you know, it's like, why do we train in the breath? Oh, it just kind of calms me down, kind of puts me into harmony. And suddenly when I'm in a harmony, I'm in the moment, and I go, oh, well, you know, anicca, impermanent, just happened to me. And there's a hard thing to let go of, though. It all worked out just fine. And I was, yeah, I had this thing. Oh, this is an interesting piece because I stomp my feet and I walk and I kind of went, oh, come on, John. Just kind of feel your body, feel your breath, kind of be here. And suddenly I went, oh, how desperate this person was. And this was in a parking lot with those, one of those cameras on them, and there were people around, you know. And suddenly, and I don't know where he was at or whatever, and it didn't matter to me. It was just suddenly there was that moment of, oh, somebody was, they were suffering so much that they took this risk, you know. And actually it was it was really healing at that moment. It's like, okay, I can deal with this. But it took that, first of all, that sense of bringing my mind into my body, grounding myself, which I had to stomp pretty hard, by the way. And then at that moment, there was really that sense of, oh, I think I get this, you know? And there wasn't really that sense of separateness kind of dissolved, and also anger and fear, you know, because they're both there. And then there was like, oh, oops, you know, now I see that this is not out of nowhere. This is someone in kind of desperate and kind of suffering. Yeah. So it's wonderful to have spiritual friends. You know, wherever you live, whether it's a partner or a next-door neighbor or your community. And, you know, for years there, because I live up in Nevada City and I have a center and stuff up there now and all this stuff. And when I first started, though, I came every week, and it was a really small group, and this was in the 80s, and very few people showed up, you know. And I can say, the first day long I gave, nobody came. This, you know, why not, you know? But one of the things was, I made this decision to go every Monday night, you know, and that somehow there was, I knew there was something bigger going on. And usually what would happen is I'd be really tired from work and I'd be kind of grouchy and go, nah, I don't want to go, it's getting dark, you know? But almost every time I would go, and as soon as I got to, it just like got together with a few people and we sat, you know, it was so incredibly really altering and changing for me, you know. But it was that thing I had to make the decision to go, and sometimes it was somebody else or their story or something that actually brought me out of, sometimes I was physically very tired and grouchy, and that I actually was able to say, oh, you know, once I touch into the truth in the community and the simple practice of just shutting up and sitting down, then that's what works. I think the last piece here is, you know, those marks of existence, you'll always be working with these, you know. But I also encourage you, you know, there would have been this thing of, I know for me, the taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha may seem like a little thing, but it's actually a big thing, you know, because we're protective creatures. And even if we don't understand it, there's a sense of actually kind of giving in or surrendering that happens, you know? And that it's why I've spent so many years in Asia. Their devotion is so great in their faith. And as I said in the last talk, I don't have a whole lot of faith. So I go and I borrow it, you know? But in just borrowing it, it just warms my heart. And it really comes from this, you know, this thing that asking for refuge, asking for shelter, you know, that and safety, you know, and having something that you can do with that. So I'm going to end here with a poem by David Budbill. This is one read over the years. It's called Bugs in a Bowl. Han Shan, that great, crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, "We're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl." I say, that's right, every day climbing up the steep sides, sliding back, over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself. Or, look around, see your fellow bugs. Walk around and say, "Hey, how you doing? Say, nice bowl." So, let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your attention.